Unemployment, recession, politics, revolutions, all of that will take a backseat for a few hours this evening, at least if you're a diehard football fan. You'll be listening to a theme like this, and then you'll be watching as the NFL regular season gets underway. Tonight, the previous two Super Bowl champs face off. The Green Bay Packers host the New Orleans Saints. And to talk about that game and the upcoming season, we've brought in NPR's Mike Pesca. And Mike, the labor dispute in the NFL is over. We're actually going to have some on-the-field action. Even President Obama made things convenient for football fans. He scheduled his speech on jobs around this game tonight.
Yeah, this season, you mentioned labor. It's not only that. I think it's a little different than a few seasons past. I mean, last year, Ben Roethlisberger, the Steelers quarterback, was suspended for off-the-field indiscretions, if not illegalities. The year before that, there was the cloud of Michael Vick's return. There's none of that this year. It's cleared for just the game of football. And I think right now, this Packers-Saints game is going to focus football fans' attention in a way that last year and the year before that and for a few years hasn't been as intently focused on the game itself.
So a fresh start, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the defending Super Bowl champions, the Green Bay Packers. They beat my Pittsburgh Steelers. I should mention it was a nail-biter, but are they the favorites to repeat this season?
Usually it's very hard to repeat in the NFL. It hasn't happened since the New England Patriots did it in back-to-back years in after the 2003-2004 season. The reason is that teams are basically equal, and usually after a team wins the Super Bowl, they lose players to free agency. There's a net loss. But the other reason is that when a team wins a Super Bowl, they usually got pretty lucky in terms of injuries. But that did not happen with the Packers. In fact, the Packers were extremely unlucky in terms of injuries. So if you look at that, if their luck evens out, and if they have many fewer injuries than last year, I think they do have a strong shot at repeating. The big impediment to the Packers returning to the Super Bowl is their conference foe, the Philadelphia Eagles. The Eagles made so many excellent free agent signings during the offseason, and they're an offensive team, so they're stocked, and they could, especially with their quarterback Michael Vick, and if he stays healthy, they could really challenge the Packers out of the NFC.
Okay, so the Eagles and a Packers team that might be even scarier this year if they remain healthy. Let's go from the NFC to the AFC, who's looking good.
Well, let's keep with the green-clad teams, and the Jets are the only team that have made the conference championship games the last 2 years, and they have an exciting coach, Rex Ryan, and a great defense. But in their division, the New England Patriots are actually favored to be the team that comes out of the AFC to go to the Super Bowl. And of course, there's that certain black and gold clad team that plays in a stadium named for ketchup that you know and root for. And yes, the Pittsburgh Steelers should be strong again.
Well, that's good to hear. Any surprises? I mean, I know people in Detroit are going to say, please don't jinx us. But the Lions did have an undefeated preseason. Do they have any hope?
Yeah, well, the jinx there is, remember a couple years back when they didn't win a game all year? Guess how their preseason went that year? They were undefeated.
Undefeated then and very defeated during the regular season.
Right. But no, I do think the Lions, and a lot of people do think the Lions, could be a surprise team. And the other team, maybe the Houston Texans. I mean, they're a team that has great offense, and if their defense is just passable and okay, they could be the surprise team, especially if Peyton Manning, the quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts, does not return from injury. He will not be playing in week one. He had offseason neck surgery. And if the Colts wane, it could be to the Texans' benefit.
All right. Well, as we like to say, are you ready for some football? It's NPR's Mike Pesca. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
When the real world seems a bit drab, author Alan Heathcock turns to the supernatural. For our series, You Must Read This, he recommends the stories of Algernon Blackwood.
Smoke from the campfire swirls up into the darkness. I peer up through the woods and wonder if I'm alone. My imagination was forged by storytellers, my father spinning tales of decapitated coal miners running through fields of corn, my mother telling me, like a secret, about waking in her childhood home to see an Indian brave in the moonlight, watching her through her bedroom window. Nothing makes the world more alive to me than a ghost story, and when I need my fix of spectral wonder, I turn to the best ghost stories of Algernon Blackwood. Though Blackwood is better known with horror fans, I feel something deeper, more literary, at work in his stories. He described a new consciousness of people coming to startling confrontation with a universe beyond natural. In the story, the Wendigo, a hunting party in the Canadian wilderness, comes in contact with a spirit creature out of Algonquin mythology, sparking cannibalistic desires, not for the gory devouring of flesh, but for those confounding fears that make even the best of us, in times of peril, consume ourselves. Many stories like The Empty House and The Other Wing deal with classic Gothic architectural spaces, while others, like Ancient Lights and The Glamour of Snow, play up human naivete against the malefic mystery of the natural world. The best of them all, the greatest ghost story I've ever read, is Blackwood's supernatural masterpiece, The Willows. Two men canoeing down the Danube become stranded on a small island, mid-river, with a storm bearing over them. The setting is compelling, an island of willow trees thrashing in the wind. The suspense is chilling, wondering if these men will escape the storm and the trees alive. But more than anything, Blackwood opens a new universe of truth, and as the wind-whipped willows release human-shaped shadows into the night, our character turns inward, confessing to a vague feeling in me I wish to face and probe to the bottom. It's been years since I first read Blackwell's stories, and yet they remain like lenses over my eyes. And in the summer, when I go into the woods to camp, I inevitably gaze up into the night sky and wonder about all that is us, that is not our bodies. And then they are there, those glimpses of mystery that slip in and out of our world like dreams in smoke.
Alan Heathcock is the author of the short story collection, Volt.
More than 20 years ago, the Libyan writer Hisham Mattar's father disappeared. His father was an opponent of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and was in exile when he was kidnapped. He hasn't been seen since. Just as Gaddafi's regime was collapsing this summer, Hisham Mattar published a novel about an exile who's kidnapped. Anatomy of a Disappearance is told from the point of view of the victim's son.
All that I did not know about my father, his private life, his thoughts, why he was kidnapped and by whom, what he had actually done to provoke such actions, where he was at this moment, whether he could be counted among the living or the dead, was like a mask that suffocated me. I felt guilty, too, as I continue to feel today, at having lost him, at not knowing how to find him or take his place. Every day I let my father down.
Hisham Mattar reading from Anatomy of a Disappearance, his new novel. He's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The passage that you read is the memory of a young man who doesn't know where his father is now. And in fact, you choose to tell this story through a 14-year-old. He's 14 at the time of the kidnapping, which means he knows even less. He's not really sure what it was his father was doing that was making anybody angry. He's not really sure who kidnapped him, although it's believed that a Gaddafi-like government kidnapped him. Why tell the story that way?
I think ultimately, you know, one of the ways into contemporary Middle Eastern history is to use the construct of the father and son.
What do you mean?
The older generation, the generation of the father, were the audacious ones, the ones that were reckless politically and had these high dreams and didn't blush when they spoke about it. My generation were the generation that were restrained, the generation that was shy about speaking about these things.
You're saying your father's generation was the one that dreamed of modernizing and bringing ahead the Middle East and building a new world. And that younger people, people of your age, and how old are you, may I ask?
I'm 40.
People of your generation went along with the dictators who ended up in charge of these various countries for a long time.
Well, everybody went along, but I do sense, and I have sensed since I was very young, that I'm part of a generation that isn't as audacious as the generation before. A generation, and actually I think that lack of audacity is not such a bad thing. I think my generation's inability to speak in absolute terms when it comes to politics is a very positive thing. It's made us more nuanced, made us more complex, now we see that the newer generation, the generation of the present revolutions, you know, one of the nicknames of the Libyan revolution is the revolution of the young men in falling jeans.
So they are people 10 or 20 or even 25 years younger than you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it seems like Audacity had skipped a generation.
Now, what have you thought as you have watched the revolution specifically in your country? I think you told someone a few months ago you're consumed by this story.
It's a moment of dramatic transition. It's embedded in it also a great deal of uncertainty and anxiety. But what is certain is that people have glimpsed another possibility. They have just a very quick glimpse of what it might be to live in a just and dignified way. And that might take a long time to be realized, but I believe that once you see that, once a people see that, it's impossible to erase it.
When was the last time you were in Libya?
My family left Libya in 1979, so I haven't been to Libya in 32 years.
How vivid are your memories of your childhood in Libya?
Very vivid. You know, as a writer, I know that some of the most powerful memories are those when you are very, very young. After that, everything becomes, it's as if sort of seen through a reflection. You know, adult life is seen through the reflection of complex rational thoughts, you know. Yeah. Whereas when you're young, it's so immediate, and a lot of the sensations are for the first time. So it's very vivid, but it's also abstract. So there's always a question of, you know, why didn't you get over it? You know, if you were a sensible human being, you wouldn't be thinking about Libya anymore. But I'm not sensible. I'm deeply involved with Libya for many reasons. I think mostly because I'm in love with it, but also because my family history is so intertwined with the country.
So you left the country in 1979 because your father had disagreements with the regime, and you lived abroad in Cairo, if I'm not mistaken. Your father was picked up in 1990.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, after we left Libya, my father became a very vocal opponent to the Gaddafi regime. And we lived in Egypt, which was a safe place for people who were on the wrong side of the Libyan dictatorship, up to the late 80s, when they started to become friends, but also they realized that they could help each other.
The Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt and the Gaddafi dictatorship in Libya.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that they did was to hand over dissidents that were residing in each other's countries. So my father was a victim of that. He was kidnapped by the Egyptian secret services. And he effectively disappeared. We later found out that he was sent to Libya, where he was tortured and imprisoned, never subjected to a trial, so we don't even know what he's technically accused of. And the dictatorship continued until its end to deny this fact, and the Egyptian dictatorship also.
Could your father still be alive in Libya somewhere?
It's a possibility. You know, it's impossible to give up hope until you know, really. I recently went to a fishing village in Ireland. And it's the only place I went to where I found people that feel exactly the same way as I do about my father. There are several fishermen who had disappeared, you know, because they fish on their own on these tiny boats, very high sea. So I met this lady who's about my age. When she was 8 years old, her father went out to earn his keep, and he never returned. She can't entirely give up hope that he is somehow alive, you know. On some level, it seems a far clearer situation. Sea, man, never seen again. And it illustrates also how hope, living in hope, is a really terrible thing. I mean, people speak about hope most of the time as a very positive thing, and I understand why, and it's become sort of entered into political language and so on. But really, if you stop and think about the state of living in hope, it's a very dispossessing thing. It's a very difficult thing to live with. So when you've been living in hope for a long time, as I have, suddenly you realize that certainty is far more desirable than hope.
Hisham Mattar is the author of In the Country of Men and his new novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm David Welna at the Capitol. President Obama will be addressing a House deeply divided when he goes before the joint session of Congress tonight. Many of his fellow Democrats are hoping to hear a speech filled with bold proposals to rally a dispirited nation. California Senator Barbara Boxer says the president's feisty words in Detroit on Monday were a good start.
I hope the president keeps his fighting spirit that he displayed on Labor Day, where it was really clear that he is fighting for the middle class and jobs. And if he continues with that spirit and lays out a plan on how to get there, I think it'll be very, very riveting.
Boxer, who chairs the Public Works Committee, wants the president to push for putting unemployed people to work by rebuilding the nation's roads, bridges, and schools. Other Democrats, including Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, say now is no time for the federal government to cut back on spending.
I'm disturbed by our failure to confront the current economic crisis with the boldness and vision that earlier generations of Americans summoned in times of national challenge. Smart countries, Mr. President, in tough economic times, do not just turn a chainsaw on themselves.
Yet the most significant proposal Democrats may get from the president tonight is for Congress to extend the one-year payroll tax break it approved last December. Dick Durbin, the Senate's number two Democrat, says it's meant an extra $1,000 for the average working family.
It accounts for 2% of income. That, to me, is sensible. Put spending power in the hands of working families, lower and middle income families. These are the people who are struggling paycheck to paycheck. We've done that. We should continue to do that.
Republicans disagree. The Senate's number three Republican, Lamar Alexander, says while he's for most tax cuts, he's not for this one.
I'm not for short-term provisions that are gestures, but don't provide certainty over the long term and don't help create jobs.
But just 9 months ago, Alexander was among many Republicans who praised the payroll tax cut. He told NPR's All Things Considered back then that it would be good for businesses in his home state of Tennessee.
Employees who work there will get a one-third reduction in their payroll tax payments every 2 weeks, and maybe they'll spend some more money creating more jobs.
That congressional Republicans like Alexander should no longer be willing to let workers get that tax break indicates the challenge President Obama faces here tonight. Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell says the president is welcome.
And we certainly intend to listen politely to the recommendations the president has. But I think I can pretty confidently say everybody in the Republican conference and the Senate thinks that we need to quit doing what we've been doing. Quit borrowing, quit spending, quit threatening to raise taxes, and quit having a big wet blanket on top of the private sector economy by this explosion of regulations.
Republicans have their own plan to foster job creation, and it revolves largely around a legislative offensive this fall in the GOP-controlled House to knock down new and proposed labor and environmental regulations. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor is leading that effort, and while he did clash over the summer with the president during the debt ceiling crisis, yesterday he sought to strike a conciliatory note when asked about the president's job speech.
We really do need to focus on areas of common agreement, or those areas where we can potentially find some common agreement.
One such area, Republicans say, is the need to pass trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman called yesterday for the White House to submit those long-pending trade deals to Congress.
The president's own metrics when applied to these three agreements means 250,000 new jobs. So it seems to me this is one where Republicans and Democrats alike ought to be telling the president, if you're really interested in helping the American worker, send us these agreements.
Still, many congressional Democrats remain wary of passing more trade deals, just as they're skeptical of the GOP's latest push for deregulation. One thing everyone agrees on in Congress is that millions more jobs are urgently needed. Just how to make that happen is what divides them, no matter what the president says tonight. David Welna, NPR News, The Capitol.
For football fans, the wait is over. The NFL season gets underway tonight in Green Bay, Wisconsin at Lambeau Field, where the defending Super Bowl champion Packers are hosting the New Orleans Saints, the previous Super Bowl champs. To talk about the first game of the year and the season ahead, we're joined by NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. And Tom, the Green Bay Packers are entering the season as the reigning champs. As we say, what are their chances of repeating?
Well, I think pretty good. Everyone is afraid to pick the Packers because it's so hard to repeat as a Super Bowl winner. It's only happened once in the last dozen years. But Green Bay won the Super Bowl last season after losing two key offensive players to injury for much of the season. Those players are coming back. Running back Ryan Grant, tight end JerMichael Finley, they're back. They're healthy. Aaron Rodgers is a great quarterback. They have a strong defense. What's not to like, Melissa?
I don't know. Tom, you mentioned injury to offensive players, and that brings us to the Indianapolis Colts. They are starting their season without their superstar quarterback, Peyton Manning. He went in today for neck surgery. How badly is he hurt?
Yeah, he did. That's kind of shocking, late-breaking news today. He had surgery in late May to repair a bulging disc in his neck, and as you say, he went in today for his third surgery in the last 19 months. He had what's described as a single-level anterior fusion, which means they took out the damaged disc to relieve pressure on a nerve, and then they filled in the space where the disc was with bone from another part of the body. Now, the team says he should be able to fully resume his career, but that rehab is typically an involved process. The Colts aren't estimating when he'll be back. They're going to keep him on the active roster until they have a clearer picture of his recovery process. But really, Melissa, Peyton Manning is the Indianapolis Colts. Mm-hmm. So suddenly 2011 looking like a very challenging year, to say the least.
Tom, there are going to be some changes to the game on the field this year, including to kickoffs. What's happening?
Well, yeah, the most visible change is moving the kickoffs up from the 30 to the 35-yard line. This means more kickoffs will go into the end zone, preventing runbacks. And the NFL thinks running the ball back and teams covering those runbacks, it's become too dangerous. Now, this is part of the league's push since last year to make the game safer for players, prompted, of course, in large part by the recent publicity about the effects of head injury in football. This offseason, the league tightened rules even more to protect players. The NFL threatened to but didn't suspend anyone last year. Officials vow to do that this season with guys who break the rules, especially so-called repeat offenders.
But Tom, if the changes that you're talking about are designed to make the game safer for players, prevent head injury, for example, why are some players grumbling that they don't like these changes?
You know, some of them think that Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, is legislating toughness out of football. Pittsburgh Steelers all-pro defensive back Troy Polamalu summed up the anger this way in an article in Sports Illustrated. He said, when you start conforming to these rules, you take away the aspect of fear, and overcoming fear is what makes us men. It's what challenges us. You take that away, you kind of make the game for everybody.
Hmm. Last question, Tom, has to do with fantasy football and a change at NFL stadiums this year. Mm-hmm. The league has ordered teams to post fantasy statistics at all home games. Why are they doing that?
Yeah, I know. I'm heading to the stadium because of that. As popular as it is, the NFL realizes the football experience for more and more people involves watching at home on huge TVs, high-def TVs, with your laptop at hand, checking fantasy stats and not paying a lot of money for tickets. This is a nod to fantasy's importance, but it's also a way to keep the fans going to games. That's very important for the NFL.
Okay, NPR's Tom Goldman. Tom, enjoy the game.
Thanks.